He took her arm and directed her east. She inhaled several deep breaths, let herself be led down the sidewalk.
On Madison Avenue?
He wasn't dead when we left. You saw that, right? He'll probably be okay, don't you think? He was so young.
Daniel Reardon didn't speak for a moment. He said,
I don't know, Gabriella. It depends on where you shot him.
He was married. He had a wedding ring on. Maybe he has children.
Gabriella?
I didn't mean to. I panicked. I didn't want to hurt anybody. But they were going to stop me, and I couldn't let them. It was for Sarah. You understand. I had to do something.
People can get shot and still live.
The ambulance would be there soon, right? Probably minutes.
At 74th and Lexington, they dodged through traffic and paused at a light next to a pushcart vendor who called,
You want hot dog? Pretzel?
He gazed at them with some curiosity. When they ignored him, he turned to another customer and fished a Frankfurter out of the gray Frankfurter water. The light changed and they crossed. She said,
People are looking at us, Daniel.
At you, Mac, not us.
What?
Because you're beautiful.
She gave a wan smile. She nodded at a souvenir shop.
Hats,
she said, pointing to a rack.
Good.
They stepped inside. She grabbed the first one she saw. But Daniel smiled and said,
Maybe not.
It sported a Lady Gaga logo in glitter.
Oh.
She picked a plain navy blue baseball cap. He picked a black one.
Jackets?
But all the store sold was brightly colored and sequined I Heart New York gear, worse than the glitzy hat. Outer camo would have to wait. They both also bought new luggage, small backpacks, hers black, his dark gray. Daniel paid, cash, and they pulled on the caps and stuffed their gym bags into the new packs.
Not much of a disguise, but different enough.
At the door, Daniel gazed out, looking for police, looking for the man in the yellow shirt, looking for Joseph.
Nothing.
But...
She took his arm and grew serious.
Listen, Daniel. This isn't right. It's time for you to leave. Get out now. I don't think they even saw you back there when I shot him. Get away from me.
She choked.
This isn't your problem.
He bent forward fast and kissed her on the lips.
Okay. That's it.
She blinked in surprise.
What?
Do you watch that show CSI?
I used to.
Well, now you've got my DNA on you. If they catch you, I'm going down too.
She smiled.
Oh, Daniel.
It'll be okay, Mac. I promise.
Mac?
She blinked, hearing him use this name.
You're more of a Mac than a Gabriella. And come on, with a last name like Mackenzie, don't tell me nobody's ever called you Mac.
True.
Gabriella didn't tell him that she and her father used nicknames for each other, and the one he'd bestowed on his daughter was indeed Mac.
You mind?
She smiled.
I love it.
And I may just love you,
Daniel whispered. She stiffened at the word, then let herself go and pressed against him, shoulders to thigh. And for a fleeting moment, the horrors of the weekend vanished. Chapter 24. 10 a.m. Sunday. 1 hour, 10 minutes earlier. Daniel and Gabriella had checked out and were sitting at a wobbly table in a coffee shop on the Upper East Side. She nodded back to the hotel in which they'd spent the night.
You always take girls to dives like that?
Only the ones I think can handle it. You passed the test.
She gave a wry smile and turned back to her task. Dozens of documents sat in front of them. Business records, letters, copies of emails. She examined the last few in the pile. She leaned back. It looks like there's close to $1 million in, quote, miscellaneous assets that my boss has. But there's no clue where they could be.
It's so unfair.
To know there's money out there, enough for the ransom, but not know where it is. How the hell am I going to get Joseph his goddamn money? Daniel had examined his half of the documents, and he admitted he'd found nothing either. Gabriella's coffee sat untouched before her. Daniel was drinking tea. Two bags sat in the cup, dyeing the water ruddy brown. Not many people drank tea, she reflected. Her mother did. For the past 6 years, though, the woman mostly just stared at the cup of cooling English breakfast on the table in the assisted living home. Forget that. Concentrate. This is important. This is vital. Gabriella found herself sweating. She wiped her palms on her blue jeans. She'd peeled off the windbreaker, but the restaurant was hot, and her wool sweater, which she'd knitted herself, was warm. The pale green garment was thick. She remembered picking out the yarn, searching online to find a good pattern for the collar and sleeves, an Irish chain. She sipped coffee and picked at toast, for which she had no appetite. Then, with both hands, she gestured desperately at the documents and muttered, "Where do we go from here?
Safe deposit boxes? The police will have found them all, locked them down."
They were silent, surrounded by the sound of the milk steamer, Muzak from CDs offered for sale, a little conversation and a lot of clattering keyboards. Looking out the window, she noted the silhouette of the Queensboro Bridge, 59th Street. It was stark against an indifferent sky. Gabriella had a sip of coffee, then another. It was bitter. She didn't mind. A sharp flavor made her alert.
"Did you find anything about this mysterious Gunther?"
he asked. "Nothing, no."
"What about family property?"
"What do you mean?"
"Your boss's parents, brothers and sisters, someplace that was held in a different name than Prescott."
Gabriella said quickly, "Yes, yes, there is." Her eyes grew wide. "That could be it. When Charles's father died last year, he and his siblings were going to put the family home on the market, but they decided they had to fix the place up first. Charles would go up there every few months to work on it. It's still being renovated."
"Whose name was it under?"
"It was a trust the lawyers named something like 109 Bedford Road Trust."
"The police might not have heard about it yet."
She continued, "I've seen pictures. It'd be perfect to hide money. It's old, 200 years, and has dozens of rooms and a huge basement. How big is $1 million?
Daniel laughed. "I wouldn't know. My clients use wire transfers, but it's probably not as big as you'd expect. Where is the house?"
he asked. "Near Ridgefield, Connecticut, in the western part of the state near the New York border."
"I know it. We could get up there and back in time before the deadline. We can take my car. I garage it a couple blocks from here."
But then he frowned and asked,
"Is the phone up there still working?"
"I don't know. Why?"
"You better try it first before we show up."
"Why? You think Charles is hiding there? The police traced him to the Caribbean."
"No,"
Daniel said.
"I think the police might be there."
"Oh, of course." She lifted her mobile. But Daniel stopped her, pointing to a payphone in the back of the shop. "You think they're tracing calls?" she asked.
"I'm way past paranoia at this point."
She rose and walked to the phone, lifted the receiver and fed in some coins. 2 minutes later, she was back at the table, scooting the chair next to him. She offered a rueful look. "Good decision, Daniel."
"Who answered?"
he asked. "Detective Holloway, Connecticut State Police. I said it was a wrong number and hung up." Gabriella sighed, and her body seemed to collapse in on itself. Daniel wasn't much taller than she was, maybe 3 inches, but she was so diminished at the moment that he seemed to tower over her. Her head was tilted downward.
"That was our last chance. Oh, Sarah," she muttered. "What am I going to do, Daniel, if we don't get that money?"
But then she fell silent and cocked her head. "Wait, wait." She plowed once more through the documents spread out before them.
"What?
You look like a wolf going after a sheep." Her dark fingernail underlined some entries on a business form. These are accounts of non-deductible expenses that Charles had. Personal accounts. I never paid any attention to them before because they didn't have anything to do with the business. Reading through the documents again, Gabriella pointed to some entries. He spent close to $100,000 at jewelry and department stores last year. Some of the items he had delivered to an address on Madison Avenue, a woman named Sonia Dietrich.
Who is she?
I never heard of her. I know Charles dated some, but he never mentioned who he was seeing.
No woman ever came by the office.
Perusing the balance sheets and ledgers again.
Hell, he did more than buy her presents. He wrote dozens of checks to her, too. 100,000, a little more.
And maybe gave her some cash.
It could be, she said excitedly. She might have the missing million.
Daniel asked,
would she have left the country with him?
Gabriella said, considering he's a wanted man, Charles is probably the last person she'd want to be seen with. Women like her have a sixth sense. Survival, you know.
He'd noted a certain tenor.
Like her? I thought you didn't know her.
Intuition, she said dryly.
How should we handle it?
He asked.
I could call and tell her...
She debated. No, how's this? I could tell her the police are looking for people connected with Charles. He wanted me to pick up anything he left with her to keep her in the clear.
Including a large satchel of $100 bills? I don't think that'll work.
No, I suppose not.
Well, how about this? I'll tell her if I don't get the money, I'm going to the police and reporting that she's been hiding stolen money for him. What do they call that?
Bagman.
I'll tell those detectives she's a bagman. Well, bag woman. I get the $500,000 and she doesn't go to jail.
I like that a lot better.
Stuffing a crumpled napkin into his cup, Daniel asked,
but what if she's not home?
Gabriella thought for a moment. Then it's plan B.
Which is?
I'll break into her apartment and turn it inside out. They stood on the corner of 88th and Madison, two buildings away from the one Gabriella pointed at.
That's it. That's where she lives, his girlfriend or mistress or accomplice. Whatever Ms. Dietrich is.
Slut was the most recent job description, I thought,
Daniel reminded in a whisper. Gabriella dug through the documents in her purse. She then placed a call and held the phone to her ear. After a few seconds, she put the unit away. She said,
voicemail. I guess we assume she's not there.
As opposed to assuming she's not answering because she's busy cleaning her shotgun?
He looked boyish. He looked charming. And he seemed a bit charmed himself as he scanned her face.
Okay, we go with the alternative.
Plan B. Wait here a minute, she told him, and walked into the lobby of the elegant brownstone looking over the mailboxes. She returned to Daniel.
Brother, she's got the whole second floor.
They gazed at those windows, which were dark. The rooms seemed to be unoccupied.
Come on, she said.
They walked into the alleyway beside the building. All the windows on the ground floor were barred with elaborate, scrolly grates. The second floor windows, however, were not protected, and one was partly open.
Help me.
They wheeled a dumpster below it. Gabriella then turned and walked back to the street, with Daniel following. She surveyed the scene. The sidewalk wasn't crowded.
The alley's narrow, she pointed out.
There's no reason for anybody to look into it and see me.
You're really going to break in?
Yep, I sure as hell am.
She noted a closed antiques store on the corner. In front were two massive Chinese lions secured to the sidewalk with massive chains.
Who on earth would steal them, she thought.
How could you fence 800 pounds of ugly sculpture?
You wait there and, I don't know, pretend to make a call. If you see anybody walk up to the building, call me.
He gave her a quick kiss.
Good luck.
He retreated 10 feet and took out his mobile. Gabriella started back to the alley. She had just reached the mouth when, with a staccato flutter of urgent, official lights, an unmarked police car, followed by a blue and white NYPD cruiser, skidded to a stop in front of the building. Daniel started forward, but Gabriella subtly gestured for him to stay where he was. The two detectives who'd stopped the pair yesterday, Kepler and Serrani, climbed out of the unmarked police car. A uniformed officer, blonde and young, exited the cruiser. None of them looked Daniel's way. Kepler gestured toward where they stood on the sidewalk.
Come on over here, Ms. McKenzie.
She didn't move.
Please. Now.
She hesitated, then joined them.
Tell us what you're doing, Serrani insisted, though politely.
That's my business.
Well, explain what that business is and why it involves an alleyway. I wasn't breaking any laws, she shot back.
No? Were you just speculating here? Thinking of maybe breaking into somebody's apartment?
From Kepler, of course, and delivered frosted with sarcasm. That's ridiculous. A friend of my boss lives here.
Friend?
Kepler asked sarcastically. We know about Ms. Dietrich, Sarani said. Gabriella snapped. I have every right to talk to her, Kepler asked.
About what?
And I have every right not to tell you that. Her eyes swiveled toward the antiques store, the massive lions. Daniel was standing behind some spectators 20 feet away. He was close. He could hear the exchange, she could tell. But not so near that the cops noticed him. Her frown told him to stay there.
What exactly were you going to do? Whisper to Ms. Dietrich from below the window?
Kepler looked at the dumpster.
Very Romeo and Juliet.
And what are you doing here? She demanded. Kepler laughed.
You got quite the attitude for a burglar. In answer to your question, since you haven't cooperated, and since Charles Prescott is still wanted on suspicion of 24 felonies, we're pursuing other leads in the case. One of them sent us here. Tell us what you know about Ms. Dietrich.
Nothing. I was worried about Charles. I just wanted to ask her if she'd heard from him, how he's doing.
Again, I ask, through the window?
Kepler offered and ignored her bitter glare. He added,
They make these things called telephones, you know. But we'll have time to talk about it in detention.
What?
We searched your boss's office again. We checked the inventory and found some things missing. Gabriella McKenzie, you're under arrest for obstruction of justice.
He sounded as if he'd been looking forward to saying those words for some time. She blurted, No! As if he couldn't resist himself, Kepler added,
And we'll throw in an attempted burglary count just for the hell of it.
A glance into the alley.
A dumpster? Really?
You don't understand. My...
Her voice trailed off.
Your what?
Sarani asked.
Please, I can't afford to go to jail right now.
Kepler laughed.
Sorry if it's inconvenient.
He turned away to jot some entries in a notebook and gestured to the uniformed officer. His name badge said Patrolman Chapman. He stepped up to her.
Set your bag down and turn around. Put your hands behind your back.
Please!
Now, turn around!
The officer reached for his cuffs, looking down to locate them. When he did, Gabriella lunged forward and ripped his automatic pistol from his holster. The crowd gasped and scattered.
Gabriella!
Kepler shouted. He moved in fast and gripped her arm. They grappled, and Gabriella went down hard on her side, crying out in pain. But she broke free and swung the gun toward his face. He winced and ducked, waving his hand as if to ward off the bullets.
Now back off!
She screamed and aimed at the detectives.
You two! Throw your guns away! Now! Under those cars!
Sarani called desperately.
Don't do this! You...
But she regarded them with a cold look, and they tossed their weapons where she'd indicated. As her gaze was momentarily drawn by the tumbling guns, wincing as if afraid one would fire, the uniformed officer surged forward, trying to tackle her. Gabriella broke away but stumbled. As she tried to right herself, the gun discharged. The young cop blinked, grabbed his chest, and dropped to the pavement.
Oh! Oh!
Gabriella gasped. Sarani ignored both her and the pistol, which she still held, and ran to the fallen officer, whose arms were flailing, feet kicking. The detective bent over him and shouted over his shoulder,
Call it in!
Kepler said in a raspy growl,
You bitch. Shoot me if you want to, but I'm getting him help.
He pulled out his radio. Sobbing, Gabriella backed away, then turned and ran. At the corner, she tossed the gun into a sewer grating. She joined Daniel, who was looking equally shocked. She started to sprint again, but he stopped her.
Just walk. Look down and walk.
I
just walk. Slow. Walk.
Gabriella nodded, inhaled deeply several times, and took his arm. They headed east. Soon, only seconds later, the banshee call of sirens cut through the chill afternoon air, from a dozen directions at once. Chapter 23. 9:45 a.m. Sunday, 15 minutes earlier.
Okay,
Kepler said, looking up from his phone.
The address is Madison at 88.
And what's that supposed to be? Sarani asked.
Charles Prescott's girlfriend.
He looked down at a sheet of paper.
Sonia Dietrich.
This is all so damn complicated,
Sarani griped.
You've been cussing a lot lately,
Kepler said.
Not like you.
Not like me? Because people of South Asian heritage, that's Indian to you, but not your kind of Indian, don't swear? People who work in call centers don't swear?
That's racist,
Kepler said indignantly.
What do you mean, my kind of Indian? I don't go to the casinos.
Casinos?
Sarani riposted.
My point exactly. There you go.
His gray-complexioned face turned to his partner with a look of smug triumph. He took off his suit jacket and hung it over a chair. Kepler was continually surprised at how his partner could be so slim, yet so muscular. The man played soccer most weekends, cricket sometimes, a game Kepler simply couldn't get his head around. Thinking he really should get serious about the golf, Kepler waved his hand, which meant the argument was over. A figure appeared in the doorway of the operations room.
Ah, it's Rookie 3 name,
Kepler said, eyeing the name badge.
Fred Stamford Chapman reporting for duty, the young blonde officer said.
His tone evidenced a bit of attitude, Kepler thought.
And if you're interested, for the record, I swear all the damn time,
said the kid, who apparently overheard the conversation.
Anyway, swearing isn't swearing anymore. It's different.
Attitude. Kepler gave him a that's not funny, so watch yourself look. Blondie shut up and decided not to offer what he'd been about to, whatever it was.
All right, Fred Stamford Chapman,
the rookie said.
Why don't you call me Stosh? Nah, you're definitely a Fred Stamford Chapman,
Kepler said, like he was bestowing an honorary title.
Definitely, Sarani echoed.
Now listen up.
Kepler briefed the patrol officer on the Charles Prescott op and, even though he remained a little smartass around the eyes, the kid seemed to get it, and even made a few good suggestions. Then Kepler said,
Let's get some breakfast. Something big.
And expensive, Sarani added. Kepler let drop,
We'll charge it to patrol. Our Viking warrior here will sign for it.
The kid was silent for a moment. He'd be thinking that even on stakeout operations, he had to buy his own food.
Me? This case is so messed up. Excuse me, Gandhi,
Kepler said with a look at Sarani, who gave him the finger yet again.
That we need some Bloody Marys, too. Hell, champagne.
Champagne?
The rookie was dying. Kepler gave it a whole 10 seconds, then said,
We're screwing with you, Fred Stamford Chapman.
Yeah.
And he tried to look as if he'd known that all along.
We got time for coffee, that's it. We go to, what's the address again?
Madison and 88, he added to the new member of the team. That's where Prescott's concubine's supposed to be. The young officer said,
A concubine is a woman who exists in a marriage-like relationship, but's unable to marry her lover, usually because of a difference in social class. You wouldn't really have concubines in America. Fewer class issues, you know.
Both the detectives stared at him. The kid blushed.
I'm just saying. Jesus Christ,
Kepler muttered.
Now you're definitely buying.
Sarani, the more or less voice of reason, said, Let's get a move on. The detectives waited, continuing to stare at the patrolman.
What?
The kid's voice nearly broke. Sarani frowned.
You weren't listening?
How's that?
The briefing, just now.
I was, yeah.
But he looked uncertain, as if he maybe hadn't been listening as much as he ought to have been.
Forget about that?
Kepler pointed to a bulletproof vest sitting on a table near the door.
I'll pass,
the young officer said.
Sweat like a pig in one of those. Besides, what could go wrong?
Chapter 22. 9:30 a.m. Sunday, 15 minutes earlier. They sat together on the edge of the unmade bed, sheets warm and twisted, concentric, like hurricane clouds seen from space. Their legs touched.
We should check out soon,
Daniel Reardon said. He was looking down at Lexington Avenue as if Joseph or a crew of other killers searching desperately for the October list were stationed outside. His bag was packed. All right, Gabriella said absently. She rose and began gathering up her clothes, stuffing them back into the gym bag. Dark blue with a red Nike logo on the side. Did Nike still use that logo? She wondered. And the tagline. Just do it. She'd brought very little with her, apart from the files, and she was soon finished. She was aware of Daniel looking her over. Blue jeans and a V-neck green sweater over a cream-colored silk camisole. A light gray L.L. Bean windbreaker. Daniel was in a new outfit as well. A suit, like yesterday. Dark gray. Italian. It was perfectly pressed. He wore no tie, a concession of some sort to the weekend. The scent rising from the cloth was astringent, dry-cleaning chemicals, but she sensed a subtext of aftershave, lotion, and musk. Shoe polish, too. He was fastidious about his shoes. The combination was, for some reason, extremely arousing. Yes, they should check out, Gabriella reflected. But she didn't want to. She wanted to stay here, close to him. Very close. This was absurd under the circumstances. Yet for the moment, the feeling of desire and the possibility of a deeper, searingly hot connection enveloped her. It was then that he pulled her closer, his right hand easing like a silk scarf around her neck. She resisted, but only for the briefest of moments. Lips yielding and surging, tastes joining, heat rolling from skin to skin. The more she relaxed, the harder he gripped her. And she sensed that irresistible uncoiling within her. Another embrace, bordering on pain. Then he was backing away.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't have done that.
Though he didn't seem the least bit contrite. Despite virtually seeing the name Sarah emblazoned in her mind, Gabriella said softly, Yes, you should have. And she kissed him once more.
Let's get breakfast and keep going through our homework.
A glance at the documents.
We've got $500,000 to find.
She nodded, but found herself tempted once more to pull him down on the bed next to her. She easily pictured what would follow. Daniel was sensual with a taut body. She'd seen and felt enough of it already. A firm, unyielding grip. Lips the right combination of firm and soft. He'd have a playful tongue, and he'd use it frequently. He was a man who would enjoy taste as well as touch. He would press her down on the bed, pinioning her, which despite her obsession with control, she curiously enjoyed. Never been able to figure that one out. And then he'd devour her. One hand on her thigh, one on her breast. He'd be unrelenting, possessive, domineering. And the warmth and pleasure, like drugs, would continue, growing and growing until the end, which would be pretty quick for her. God, she wanted that. A string of mismatched lovers stretched out behind her. Mismatched and worse. But, as tempted as she was, she forced the fantasy away and ignored the warm sheets, the scents of him, the memory of his hands and mouth. Priorities. Goals. The name, Sarah. Chapter 21. 8:30 a.m. Sunday. 1 hour earlier. He had a sense that somebody was watching him. Frank Walsh was walking toward his apartment in the West Village, aware of a man in his 40s, large, with curly blonde hair sticking out from beneath a baseball cap, wearing a dark overcoat. The man was on the opposite side of Hudson Street, walking in the same direction. But it was odd.
the way this guy was walking. Anybody else would have been looking down at his feet or ahead or at the windows to his left. This guy, though, was glancing pretty frequently at the sparse Sunday morning traffic, like he was worried about cars following him. Worried why? That cops were after him? A mugger? A killer? Or was Mr. Overcoat studiously avoiding looking at his own target, Franklin Walsh himself? The 30-year-old knew about stalking up on prey, about fighting, about attacking, about survival, about blood. His instincts told him this guy was trouble. A fast glance, but the man seemed to anticipate this and looked away. Frank got only a look at a round face and that creepy hair. Tight blonde curls, slick. But this was the village, and weird was the order of the day. Then Mr. Overcoat paused to look in a window, head cocked with what seemed to be legitimate curiosity. So maybe he was just another local. Frank told himself to stop being paranoid. Besides, he knew how to take care of himself. He felt the knife in his pocket, tapped it for reassurance. Soon his thoughts drifted away from Mr. Overcoat. They even skipped over what was coming a half hour from now, the knife work he'd been obsessing over for days. And they settled on, what else? Shit. The weekend visit with his mother. She'd overfed him. She'd made him take her shopping at the most crowded mall on Long Island. And there hadn't been much to talk about with her, of course. There never was. Though the woman had managed to bring up Frank's sister's marriage at least a half dozen times. Part of that topic included the fact that Barbara and her husband would surely have a baby in the next year or so, which involuntarily had conjured an unpleasant image of his sister having sex, which put him off dinner last night, at least until dessert.
Bobby and Steve want 4, you know, ideally 1 year apart.
What was his mother's point? Did she think he could wave his wand? Bad choice of word, that. And poof, there was a wife popping out kids? Shit, didn't she know he was doing the best he could? His life wasn't like everybody else's. Who, for instance, would understand his obsession? The knives, the fighting, the blood. Also another thing, the practicality. Given his line of work, he didn't meet many women. Besides, he was holding out for one particular person. Ah, Gabriella. Tuesday, sure. Her words, punctuated with a smile. Frank was presently striding briskly back from Penn Station at Madison Square Garden. This was a pretty good walk and guaranteed to burn off maybe 100 calories, particularly in the chill autumn air. He'd purposefully taken off his jacket so his body would drop fat, burning calories in the chill, even though he didn't like looking at his round figure in the storefront windows as he passed them. He shouldn't have worn the knit shirt. It was clinging, revealing. Well, don't look, he told himself. But he did. Still, he kept the jacket off. Cold weather made you burn up to 50% more calories than you did in the heat. In the Arctic, you could eat whatever you wanted and still lose weight. He'd researched it. 6,000 calories a day. He should spend a year there. Frank glanced around again and noted that Mr. Overcoat was now on the same side of the street as he was, and the man's pace continued to match Frank's. Stalking, attacking, killing. Still, had to be paranoia. What would this guy be interested in me for? And even if he is, how could he have found me here, on the street, striding south from Penn Station? But of course, Frank Walsh knew computers cold, the good side of machines and the bad. He was well aware of phone tapping and data mining. He'd bought his ticket back to the city this morning with a credit card. He'd phoned his mother to tell her he'd made the train. If somebody wanted to, he could have found out what train Frank was on, when he'd be arriving at the station, even what he looked like, from the motor vehicle picture, even if the depiction was 30 pounds lighter than presently. He then turned the corner onto his street in the village and risked a fast look back, his hand on the knife in his pocket. The curly-haired guy was gone.
Frank continued up the block and approached his 8-story apartment building. As he got to the door, he stepped in quickly and looked around, but the quiet, tree-lined street was deserted. He stepped into the lobby and finally relaxed.
Hi, Arthur.
The doorman was old, and when he walked, he shuffled and he smelled of Old Spice.
Package for you, Mr. Walsh.
FedEx?
He was expecting the knife, the kukri. Those Nepalese were far more deadly than people thought. Cheery Sherpas, my ass.
No, it was a hand delivery. Some Hispanic fellow dropped it off yesterday.
It was a plastic bag containing something rectangular and heavy. He took it.
Thanks.
He hadn't planned to give him a tip. Frank was plenty generous around Christmas. He looked into the bag, and his heart thudded and he laughed as he read the note that accompanied it. He handed Arthur $5. The old man took it without thanks, but with a raised hand that Frank chose to interpret as undying gratitude. Frank unlocked his door and walked inside, tossing his jacket on his armchair in front of the big screen TV. The apartment, consisting of 3 rooms, was this. Dark and insanely cluttered, yet comforting, if claustrophobic at times, depending on his mood. A kitchenette with a 2-burner gas stove, an oven big enough for a TV dinner or two. His microwave sat atop a table, sharing the space with books and magazines. But back in the day, in this locale of glorious bohemian art, you created your poetry, your paintings, you smoked pot, you slept with as many women as you could, and you drank to oblivion. Cooking was secondary, if not wholly unnecessary. Frank walked to the window and looked out at Westbeth, the famous artists' community. He had a view of the very room where Diane Arbus had slashed her wrists in 71. At least that was what the real estate broker, sensing a hooked fish, had said. As if it would make this dive more appealing to be able to look out over the space where a very weird photographer had offed herself. Then, he shifted his gaze and scanned for men in black overcoats. Not a single Matrix killer with slick, curly blonde hair. He closed the curtain. Frank then returned to the delivery he'd just received and, swollen with joy, lifted out the dark green box of Dom Perignon champagne. He peeled off the note. Dear Frank, thinking of you. We'll share this soon. Really looking forward to Tuesday. I'll call you. XOXO, Gabriella. He felt like he'd just scratched off the last number in Lotto and won $1,000,000. He laughed out loud with pleasure. Champagne! And he didn't think this was the cheap stuff either. He pictured Gabby's slim waist, her high, spherical breasts, the thick, straight auburn hair that she seemed to wear up in buns or ponytails most of the time. But occasionally she wore it down, which Frank loved. God, was she pretty. He recalled seeing her in a yellow swimsuit, sunbathing in Central Park. He believed he'd seen a scar on her belly. He wondered if it was a C-section or from an accident. He wondered how he could find out. Ask her, dummy. Their coffee on Friday had been great. He must have passed a test of sorts because, look at this. He regarded the green box again, reread the note, then again, and once more.
Hell, Dom Perignon,
he Googled.
Shit, $150.
Frank began to fantasize about when she came over on Tuesday. He'd have the place spick and span, vacuumed, and air freshened. He sniffed and something smelled off. Clean sheets on the bed. Frank glanced at his watch. Well, he'd have time to think about their date later. Now, it was time for the fight. Time for death. Time for blood. His palms began to sweat. In his musty bedroom, Frank Walsh emptied his pockets onto his dresser. $43 in crumpled bills, coins, receipts, a Necco wafer wrapper, a Kit Kat wrapper, and the knife he always carried, a 2-inch Swiss Army model with magnifier, toothpick, and scissors. He opened the closet door. Inside were dozens of shoes, one suit, 4 combat jackets and a hat rack with a single piece of headgear, a Greek fisherman cap. This he grabbed and pulled over his ruddy hair. He sat down in his creaky office chair and booted up his computer, kicking his shoes off. Squinting at the computer screen, Frank moused up the volume and music trilled. Otherworldly music from a different dimension. The familiar logo filled the screen, giving him comfort, like seeing the now entering sign of your hometown. The Clans of Gravius Major, the number one online role-playing game. Frank clicked on Resume Game and motioned to life his avatar, a lean, handsome warrior whose appearance was similar to its owner in hair color only. He directed this figure to the armory to select the Darashian knife from his arsenal of weapons. Frank then flew the avatar via a winged horse into Prospecia Woods, where he would meet and fight an avatar manned by a young player in Taiwan. They'd scheduled this one-on-one battle to settle a dispute between their respective clans, as the rules of the game allowed. A few moments later, he arrived at the Judgment Circle, which was already surrounded by several dozen avatars from both clans. The people behind those creatures, none of whom Frank had ever met in person or even had a real conversation with, directed the warriors and wizards to applaud and leap up and down, offering cries of support. The other side, of course, did the same thing, encouraging their warrior. After a moment, the opposing avatar appeared, a bizarre-looking creature with a tentacle for a tail. He surveyed the fighting circle and stepped over the barrier. Frank instructed his avatar to do the same. The two animated creations faced each other. He had a brief memory of Mr. Overcoat, but it faded quickly. He had a knife fight to win. He directed his avatar to crouch and, with the wicked blade forward, he advanced on his opponent, who dropped into a defensive position as his snaky face surveyed his enemy. Frank feinted to the side and then leapt forward, knife swinging like an airplane propeller, and he clung to his strategy, pretending he was defending Gabby from being raped by the creature. Blood flew and screams rose harrowingly, shooting from the Bose speakers, a month's pay. Frank advanced again. Stalking. Attacking. Killing. Part 3. Chapter 20. 10 p.m. Saturday. 10 hours, 30 minutes earlier.
Hal, sorry to ruin your Saturday night.
Never a problem to see you, Pete.
The men pumped hands vigorously. Both right wrists, coincidentally, were encircled by gold bracelets. One tasteful, one not.
Well, sit down,
said Peter Karpenkoff, gesturing toward a chair across from the ornate but well-worn antique table he used for a desk, deep mahogany.
Have a seat. Do you want a drink? You want some whiskey? Is that your drink? You want something else?
Nah, but thanks.
Hal Dixon, body a bit stocky, suit a bit rumpled, but shirt-pressed, even now at this hour of the evening. They were on the top, the third floor, of the ancient building on 10th Avenue that housed Karpenkoff's company. The Russian poured some vodka and sipped it warm. He lifted his eyebrow.
You sure?
Nah, really, Pete. I mean, you're right, yeah, I like whiskey, but nothing for me. The wife smells it on my breath, I go home and it's all hell to pay. I can have a drink with her, but not a drink before her. You know how it is.
Aha. Women, women, women.
The lean man chuckled. He looked so much like Vladimir Putin that Dixon had wondered if he was somehow related to the Russian president. He had no accent, but sometimes you imagined he did. There was a rumble from the corner, and Karpenkoff's large dog, whose breed Dixon didn't recognize, stretched and looked over the visitor slowly. Not exactly hostile, not exactly friendly. He flopped back down on his cushion and sighed. The thing had to weigh 150 pounds. The dog's brown eyes settled on Dixon and would not let go. Black and gray fur may be naturally spiky, maybe rising, as in hackles, as in just before the attack.
He's a good boy,
Karpenkov said affectionately.
Big,
Dixon said.
Things are going good for you, I hear.
Karpenkov looked impressed.
The new shopping mall project.
Sure,
Dixon said, and kept his eyes locked with the Russians. We're making money hand over fist, even though I have no idea what the hell that expression means. Karpenkov blinked, then laughed.
That's true. I never thought about it. Hand over fist. What's that mean? People are careless, what they say. Cliches, lazy speaking, makes you sick sometimes.
Sick.
The view from Karpenkov's office was of the Hudson River. Now, at night, the water was just a strip of black. What ebbed and flowed were lights, yellow, red, green, white, easing north and easing south. Karpenkov disconnected and then turned to Dixon, who regarded the man's eyes for as long as he could.
Those are some very weird pupils,
he thought, looking away.
Not 50 shades of gray, two.
The Russian said,
I'm thinking we should talk about that project in Newark. You and me.
A joyous drumbeat tickled Dixon's gut. He said enthusiastically,
That's gonna be a ballbuster, Pete. 8 figures easy, mid 8 figures.
Then to himself,
Calm down. You're talking like a tween gushing about Bieber.
8, yeah, we're figuring.
You'll clean up with it,
Dixon said. This was a joke because part of the project involved leases to a large dry cleaning outfit. Dixon had been dying to participate. Karpenkov didn't seem to get the play on words, though. Dixon kept his face still. You had to when dealing with people like Karpenkov. But his pleasure was growing by the second. He'd been hoping for a year that Karpenkov would bring him in on some project, any project. But Newark? Jesus, that was Boardwalk. That was Park Place. But I need a favor, Hal. For a piece of Newark, he'd definitely help Karpenkov out, whatever the task. He sat forward, frowning with pleasant anticipation.
Anything.
But the details of the carrot, or stick, were delayed. Karpenkov's phone rang and he said a polite, Excuse me.
Go right ahead.
Dixon looked at the dog. The dog looked back. Dixon was the first to disengage. He lifted one shoulder, then the other, adjusting his gray suit jacket. It was tight, and the cloth was thin wool, too thin for the day's chill. He'd realized this as soon as he'd left the house, but didn't want to go back for his overcoat. The wife. His shirt was a pastel shade of blue that some people probably thought was too gaudy. Dixon didn't care. He wore bright shirts, it was his trademark. Yesterday pink, today blue. Tomorrow he'd wear yellow. The canary yellow. It was his favorite. And he always wore it on Sunday. The Russian ended his call. Then, as always happened in discussions between men, Dixon knew, the mood changed, unmistakably, and it was time for serious horse trading. Karpenkov put his fingers together, like he'd buried the pleasantries and teepeed dirt over their grave.
Now, I'm aware of something. Okay?
Karpenkov often said that.
He was aware of something. Have you ever heard of the October list?
Not familiar, nope. What is it?
I'm not exactly sure, but I do know this. It's a list of names of some people who are powerful and dangerous. About 30, maybe a few more. I've heard some of them I might have done business with in the past.
October list, why is it called that?
A shrug. Nobody I've talked to knows. A mystery. It could mean all hell's going to break loose in October.
Next month.
Next month.
Or maybe it's that something big happened last October, and there are plans in place as a result.
Now, Hal, I want that list. I need the list. But I can't have my people do it, because I may have a connection.
Those people I've worked with?
You don't have any connection.
Because I'm smaller potatoes,
Dixon thought. But that didn't bother him. He nodded eagerly, like a dog. Well, a normal dog, not the big sucker in the corner. The Russian continued.
Now, here's the thing. I heard from Henry, you know, Henry, my facilitator.
Right, I know Henry, good man.
He is, yes. He heard that there's a woman lives in the city, has the list, or knows where it is. You get the list from her, then you and me will go half and half on the Newark project.
50%?
Dixon blurted.
That's very generous, Pete.
The man waved off the gratitude. This woman's name is Gabriella McKenzie. She was the office manager of the prick who kept the list. He's skipped town. You have her address?
Upper West Side, but she's not there.
Karpenkov teepeed his fingers. He leaned forward. She and some guy she's with are keeping low, but my sources say they're in the city somewhere. His name's Reardon. My people tell me they'll find out their location tonight or tomorrow and let me know. His voice lowered further, and he put his hands flat on the table.
Hal, I heard you were the go-to man when it came to life in the streets, you know what I mean? Life in the trenches.
I try,
Dixon said modestly.
I know my way around.
Karpenkov cleared his throat. His eyes slid away to a model car on his desk, one of the six Fords, an Edsel.
And you do whatever you need to get the list? You have no problem with that, do you? Even with this person being a woman.
And innocent. Not a problem at all.
Dixon meant this, though he didn't add he already found the task a turn-on.
She's going to be skittish.
Girls get that way.
Especially depending on the time of month.
Karpenkov smiled. I mean, she'll be cautious.
I'm not the only one who wants the list. There are some other people after it.
Sure, you get me her location, and I'll take care of it.
Dixon frowned as he considered the job.
So she knows people are looking for her.
That's right.
You know one thing I've done works pretty good, especially with the ladies? I tell them I'm like a deacon in a church. It gets their guard down. I even carry a Bible around with me.
He fished the little black book out of his breast pocket.
Smart, Hal.
The man beamed.
That'll let me get up close. Then I pull out my piece and get her into my car. Take her to one of the construction sites and go to work on her. She'll tell me where the list is. And after, we're pouring concrete on Monday at the shopping center. They'll never find the body.
Good.
And the guy with her, he connected?
No, just some businessman she's sleeping with, I think.
I don't care about him.
But, a third teepee.
I'll take care of him, too. Probably better just to shoot him.
An approving nod from the Russian. I'll call you as soon as my people find her. The men rose and shook hands again, even more energetically this time, and the gold links clinked dully. Seeing Dixon grip his master's hand so fervently, the dog stood. Dixon released and stepped back immediately.
It's okay, Karpenkov said.
He likes you.
Yeah, Dixon thought, for a main course.
He smiled at the dog, who was content to stand and stare. In 5 minutes, Hal Dixon was outside on the cool, windswept street, tugging his light suit around him. He was relaxing now that he was away from organized crime overlord Peter Karpenkov and Godzilla. He began down the street with a jaunty bounce, wondering who he could sell the October list to once he made his own copy. Chapter 19. 8:30 p.m. Saturday. 1 hour, 30 minutes earlier.
Horrible,
Gabriella whispered, her teeth set close. She was quivering, eyes closed, breathing heavily.
How could he do that?
In the back of the taxi, she leaned into Daniel, and he put his arm around her shoulders. She wiped her eyes.
How could somebody do something so despicable?
Looking at the CVS pharmacy plastic bag at their feet, Gabriella eased closer yet, and he tightened his grip.
He was strong.
The nice suits he wore, the thick yet draping cloth, largely concealed his physique, but one touch of his arm left no doubt he was in good shape. She thought again about meeting him Friday, yesterday, and what had transpired. Felt a low pop within her at the memory of Daniel so very close, wiping the moisture from her forehead, then with the same handkerchief from his.
Was it just 24 hours ago? It seemed ages.
The ping again, lower, warmer, pulsing. But she pushed the thought away.
Now was hardly the time.
Sarah. A half hour earlier, their taxi had stopped at his loft in Tribeca, and he'd picked up a gym bag containing toiletries and a change of clothing. They were now on the way to her apartment so she could do the same, and, most important, collect the file folders. She told him,
"The documents might not have anything helpful, but they're all we've got to save Sarah's life. I'm grasping at straws at this point."
Now it was Daniel's gaze that settled on the plastic bag, crumpled like a tiny, pale body. Despite what they'd been through, he had remained the epitome of calm, until in that disgusting alley, he'd seen what tumbled from the sack. He'd jerked back, a more violent reaction than hers. He'd hissed, "Jesus!" The shock was gone, but in its place was a surfeit of anger and perhaps resolve.
"Why did you want to keep it?" she asked.
When they'd been in the alley, Gabriella had flung the bag away fast as if it were coated in acid. But Daniel, using his elegant silk handkerchief, had collected the sack along with its contents. He now said,
"Evidence. There'll be DNA on it."
A nod toward the bag.
"Maybe even Joseph's fingerprints, if he got careless."
"Sure. I hadn't thought about that. I was emotional."
"Pretty understandable under the circumstances."
They now drove in silence. When the cab reached Central Park and was nearing her apartment, she glanced at the driver to see if he was listening, but he was on the mobile, speaking in some Middle Eastern language, lost in his conversation. She whispered to Daniel,
"The police will be watching. Joseph could be too."
So she directed the driver to the street one block north, behind the apartment building. The yellow cab parked on a dark side street.
"I'll just be a few minutes," she told the driver.
But the waiting clock on the cab meter was running, and he couldn't have cared less what his passengers were up to. What secret missions loomed? He resumed his staccato conversation. Gabriella slipped from the cab and, walking close to the walls of the adjacent buildings as if spies were after her, made her way to the service door of her apartment. The loading dock wasn't locked, but the door leading into the basement was. Her front door key, however, let her in. In 5 minutes, she was in her apartment, which she kept dark. Working mostly by feel, she found and stuffed clothing and the business files she wanted into her nylon gym bag, and then looked out of the door carefully, checking to make sure there were no neighbors or, of more concern, NYPD officers lurking in the halls. But no one was present. She locked the door behind her. Outside once more, she slipped quickly into the back seat, and the driver eased away from the curb. Daniel pressed her knee. After several blocks,
"Sarah," she said, a plaintive musing. "I wonder what she's doing now. What's going through her mind?"
"Don't think about that,"